Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session at the end of the presentation. To ask a question at that time, please press star then one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And I'd like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Sean Wilson.
Thanks, Rebecca. Good afternoon, and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Sean Wilson. I'm one of the organizers for today's call. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us this afternoon. Today's webcast is presented by the Illinois Department of Human Services Division of Mental Health and the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. The title of today's webcast is the Statewide Utilization Management Call. You will hear from a panel of speakers today, and our speakers are Dr. Lori Rickman-Jones. Dr. Jones is the Director of the Illinois Department of Human Services Division of Mental Health. You will also hear from Leanne Reinert. Leanne is the Clinical Policy Specialist with the Division of Mental Health. Also on the panel today for the question and answer portion of this afternoon's call are Dr. Mary Smith. Mary is the Associate Director of Decision Support, Research, and Evaluation with the Division of Mental Health. Jackie Maker. Jackie is the Associate Director of Community Services with the Division of Mental Health. Rusty Dennison. Mr. Dennison is the President and CEO at Parker Dennison & Associates. Emily Sherrill. Emily is the Clinical Director at the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. And also Dr. Todd Kasdan. Dr. Kasdan is the Medical Director at the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. Before we begin the formal presentation, I would like to review with everyone a few helpful tools and housekeeping items for the online portion of the forum. If you happen to get disconnected from the audio portion, please call back into the same number you just dialed. That number is 888-455-3073, and the passcode is Illinois. The visual portion of this presentation is web-based. Of course, you can choose the audio portion only, but if you would like to log in to see the webinar presentation, the login information is located on the invite you received after you pre-registered. If you are experiencing any problems with that particular link to join, you can also go to www.joinwebinar.com. Again, that's www.joinwebinar.com, and enter the web ID directly at that page. The web ID is 638-548-034. There will be a designated question and answer portion toward the end of today's presentation. We ask attendees to hold their questions until this designated question-answer period. The operator will then open up the lines for you at that time. At the conclusion of the presentation today, we ask that you please complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum. It should take you less than 5 minutes to complete this survey, and we value your feedback. And lastly, today's call is being recorded, and the audio portion of today's call will be available for download in MP3 format by the middle of next week. As usual, these audio recordings are located on the provider information page of the collaborative's website under the provider resources heading. Again, you will see a hyperlink with today's date. So just click on that, and that will access the MP3 file for you. So with that said, without further ado, we will now begin our formal presentation for this afternoon, and I would like to now turn it over to our first speaker for today, Dr. Lori Rickman-Jones. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean. Good afternoon, everyone. And Happy New Year to all of you across the state. I want to let you know that I appreciate your being with us on a Friday afternoon. This is not a preferred time for this call, but it's been a very busy first week of the new year in state government and for DMH, and this is the only time that we could find to get this done. So, again, I appreciate you're being available for us on a Friday afternoon. We have had a number of questions about the utilization management program, and we thought it was best, and there were several misunderstandings and some clarifications that we needed to make. We thought it was best that we not postpone this and try to get this scheduled as early in the year as possible so that we could address many of the questions and concerns that people have expressed. So as a little bit of a background, I want to remind people that we are always interested in making sure that the services that we provide to consumers, first of all, are recovery-focused and that they are the right services in the right amounts given at the right time. It is our responsibility to make sure that people are served with the highest quality services, again, in the appropriate level and at the appropriate amount throughout the course of their treatment. That is guided our work in this area. We also have had to do this work in an era of massive cuts, unprecedented for the division. And again, our concern is to make sure that as many people can maintain service in the system as possible. Without these strategies, which are clinically indicated, we would not have the ability to assure that our non-Medicaid population received any services. So there are a lot of things that are driving this, and clearly that is one of them. Without implementing UM, we would not be able to support any care for non-Medicaid population. I also want you to know that 75% of all people served will not have to have reauthorization in accordance with these new procedures that we're setting forth. So most people will never have to be reauthorized for care, and we're talking about 25% of those who are high utilizers. We have had a number of questions and a lot of good input. We are continuing to listen to your concerns and will always want to listen, give feedback, and morph our system in accordance with those ideas that we think would together strengthen the work that we are both all committed to doing. So with that, I want to turn things over to Leanne. I want to thank my staff, Leanne and Jackie and Brooke, who've spent countless hours in preparing answers to your questions, thinking through these issues, and turn things over to Leanne so she can get us through the presentation. Thereafter, we will open the lines and hear if there are any more questions that remain after we've attempted to clarify those that we've become aware of already. So with that, I'll turn things over to Leanne. And again, thank you so much for participating this afternoon.
Thank you, Director. Again, my name is Leanne Reinert. I'm the Clinical Policy Specialist within the Division of Mental Health. I wanted to start today by just reviewing the reasons that we have a focus on utilization management here within the division. As the director said, utilization management really is focused on the idea of recovery, and that is that individuals receive the right services in the right amounts and at the right time, and that if they are receiving those services and moving through the system to less intensive levels of care, it allows additional people to be served within the system, which, as we know, is supported with very scarce resources at this point. In addition, we continue as a division to have a duty to manage risk in the event of a federal audit. And one of those risks is whether or not a service would be considered medically appropriate if reviewed by a federal auditor. And so for those reasons, we have to make sure that we as a division are focusing on utilization management. As we started to discuss developing a utilization management program within the division or enhancing it, we have had some utilization management for a few years now, but as we looked at the need to increase that, we did a number of activities that I wanted to just share with you a brief overview of that today. First of all, we looked at medical necessity criteria as well as models of authorization from other states and jurisdictions to try to help inform us as far as what our sister agencies were doing and to make sure that the decisions that we made were in line with practices that were common in other areas and acceptable, therefore, to CMS. We looked at many options for utilization management, and those included things like absolute benefit limits embedded within the Medicaid state plan. Those would not allow for any extension of services, so if an individual received a certain amount of service, there would be no way for the division to continue to reimburse it through Medicaid benefits. We looked at the possibility of reducing Medicaid benefits to a more narrow benefit package, reducing the types of service that would be reimbursed. Cuts in Medicaid rates have been discussed. We looked at the possibility of pre I put that in parentheses because authorization generally means that you have to do it before you provide a service, but of doing authorization for 100% of services. Those are all things that do occur in some other systems, and none of those seem to us to be very attractive options. And that's how we landed on this threshold model that's been introduced to begin in January. It seemed to be to us to be the best option among some difficult choices. One of the main reasons why the threshold option seemed to be the best to us has to do with one of the guiding principles that we followed in developing our program. As Director Jones said, where we set our threshold, 75% of individuals who have been receiving mental health services would never require external authorization. This is because one of these guiding principles is that utilization management needs to focus on outliers. And this a result of focusing on outliers is there's much less administrative cost to the system because you're only requiring review of individuals that have unique usage patterns. And this review process is used not to limit benefits to those individuals, but to make sure that those individuals that have those higher needs are getting those needs appropriately addressed and not just receiving the service that that has been the routine to provide to them, but is it really addressing their symptoms and is it really aiding them in moving on towards their recovery goals? Another of the guiding principles for our UM program is that UM is dynamic and evolutionary, and this means that we expect things to change. We expect there to be new research. We expect there to be new services, new information out there, and we will continue to analyze the data that we have, and our utilization management program will change over time. Our next guiding principle is that utilization management needs to be based in data. And we use that data to identify patterns of utilization of services, to work with the clinicians that deliver those services to determine if those patterns and variations are desirable or not. Of course, we don't expect that services would be delivered in some cookie-cutter fashion where every person who comes in gets the same services in the same amounts. We really do understand and support that services need to be designed on an individual basis. So some variation is expectable, but when we see extreme outliers, as we're going to talk about in just a few minutes, that's where we start to get concerned. And then we, of course, want to work with providers who are one of our partners in making needed improvements to this system of mental health care that we're all committed to making as effective and as possible for the citizens of this state. Our next principle is that individuals accessing services should have a consistent threshold of medical necessity statewide. So we need, as a division, to provide guidance to our providers so that regardless of where an individual receives their services, they are receiving the services that are appropriate and in the right amount, and that they are assisted in moving towards their recovery goals, and that they have fair access to those services regardless of where they live. Finally, the last guiding principle that I wanted to talk to you about was that authorization must be clinically focused and conducted by qualified staff. So where we require authorization within our utilization management program, we have contractual requirements in place that the individuals that are reviewing that information must be licensed within the state of Illinois to practice at the independent level. Now, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the services that have been added to the utilization management program for FY11 and the data that we looked at related to those services. The first one, psychosocial rehabilitation. And I wanted to just remind everyone out there in case your particular agency doesn't provide PSR, I just wanted to spend a couple minutes talking about what we intend PSR to be and when we wrote it into the rule, what we designed it to be. It's intended to be intensive. It's intended to be time-limited. It's intended to be curriculum-based. And it's intended to be a service that focuses on assisting individuals in increasing specific skills so that they are able to meet recovery goals. So if an individual is identified to lack a certain skill, then PSR is a facility-based service where the individual can go for a limited amount of time and work on developing that skill. The expectation then is that as the person acquires those skills, the agency will assist them in starting to practice those skills in natural settings through another Rule 132 service, which is community support service, because we always want to see people moving towards those natural supports whenever possible and developing those natural supports so that individuals don't have to rely solely on the mental health system for their support. And with that said, we acknowledge that there may be additional activities that are not Medicaid services that are needed by some individuals, things such as drop-in centers or other socialization-type activities. However, the continued provision of PSR to meet those needs that are outside the intended purpose of the PSR service increases the risk to the mental health system in the event of federal audit for lack of active treatment and evidence of continued rehabilitation. So we remain within the division. Committed to talking with stakeholders about ideas for developing those services that are not Medicaid services, identifying how to increase natural supports in communities. We think that's very important. But at the same time, we all have to realize that we can't use PSR in ways that it was not intended and written into the rule because it exposes us all to risk. So when we started looking at the data for PSR, We're talking about fiscal year 09 because when we started doing all of our work, that was the complete year's data that we had available to look at. So there were $28 million spent on PSR in FY 09. There were 9,329 consumers who received a PSR service. The average amount that was spent per consumer in FY 09 was $3,000, and the average units claimed per consumer was 600. However, the range of units was 1 to 9,000. 9,000 units equals over 43 hours of PSR every week all year long. And so that raises concerns for us because, again, if you think back to what I just said about the intention of PSR, the definition of PSR, and the risk with a federal audit, in the medical necessity justification of someone receiving 43 hours of intensive skill-building training every week of the year is something that would be difficult to document. Maybe not impossible, but difficult to document. So we started looking further into that data. And what we found was that there was a very disproportionate use of services when it related to PSR. 896 consumers out of that 9,000-plus consumers, so approximately 10% of the population, had usage patterns of PSR that were so statistically distant from the normal usage pattern that they had to be considered extreme value. So what that means is that if you were doing statistical analysis, you would have to completely remove them because they would skew the data so far that it would not make any sense. So over the course of a year, this 10% of PSR consumers received 43% of the dollars that the division spent on PSR. This means for every $1 spent on 90% of the people in PSR, $7 were spent on what we call this high utilizer group. Graphical representation, just because I tend to see things more visually, you see that the blue is this 90% of individuals and the red is the high utilizer. So on the left-hand side, we're seeing overall the proportion of individuals, and on the right-hand side, we're seeing how much of the cost was allotted to this small number of individuals. Then we went on to also look at therapy counseling services, and just a few numbers for you related to therapy counseling is that in FY09, the division spent $29.2 million on therapy counseling for adults and $12.9 million on therapy counseling for children and adolescents. And the number of consumers for adults was 51,939. For children and adolescents, it was 22,865. The average amount per consumer spent was $561 for adults and almost the same amount for children and adolescents, $565. However, when we look at the amount of resources according to the number of hours of service that an individual was in, we see a very different picture. And again, the slide on the left shows the kind of turquoise blue color is for individuals who received up to 10 hours of therapy in the year. So this turquoise blue on the left-hand side, this is the individuals that, from where the thresholds are currently set for our utilization management program, will never require external authorization. So it's that other 25% where we would be looking at externally authorizing continued care. When you look over to the right side and you see the very disproportionate amount of dollars that was spent on this smaller amount of individuals, and this is therapy counseling for children and adolescents. When we look at adults, it's even more more apparent that, again, we have right at 75% of adults in this turquoise area that receive 10 hours or less, and then the remaining individuals, this other 25%, are getting more than 75% of the services. So, again, we have to look at these individuals who have these unique utilization patterns and make sure that therapy counseling is the appropriate service, or is there something else that might be more appropriate and might assist them in reaching their recovery goals. So this is the reason that we focus our utilization management at the 75th percentile. We believe that this 75% on the left-hand side, it appears that this is probably pretty appropriate. We need to look at the remaining 25%. I'm going to move now into a summary of some of the questions that have been asked both in the two webinars that we did back in November, as well as additional communications that have come to the division from various sources, because we want to make sure that, as the director said, we found in reviewing the questions and in responses that came in afterwards that there were some misperceptions out there. We want to make sure that we clear up and make as clear as possible for all of you some of those misunderstandings. And what I've done is I've grouped them into areas that are also the topical areas for the Q&As that are being posted to the website. First of all, who's covered by the UM program? Individuals that are enrolled in Medicaid whose services are reimbursed by DMH are covered by our UM program. Our UM program does not cover SAS, and it does not cover ICG. Also, the Healthcare and Family Services Integrated Care Pilot is a separate program from the DMH Utilization Management Program. While we are working with HFS and sharing with them our work on utilization management, they are a separate entity, and we will continue to work with them and share with them our ideas, but those pilots are separate from our utilization management program that the collaborative will be operating. Also, the collaborative will continue to provide authorization services covered by our DMH utilization management program after the conversion to HFS for claim submission. As you are probably aware, by July 1st, the Division of Mental Health claims will be submitted from providers to HFS for processing. The collaborative will continue to handle the authorizations and will send over files to HFS informing them of those authorizations so that they can process those claims. As far as what the UM program covers, the UM program covers distinct Rule 132 services, and that's very important that people understand, and there's been a lot of confusion out there, that Rule 132 lists and describes, defines distinct services, one of which is therapy counseling. That's not to say that if an agency hires someone and their job title is therapist or their job title is counselor, that every single service that they provide and report for reimbursement by DMH is necessarily therapy or counseling services. There are times when those clinicians may do case management, they may do community support, they certainly may be doing mental health assessment and treatment planning. All of those are distinct Rule 132 services, none of which are included in the thresholds for therapy counseling. So that's one thing that has confused providers. The next service, PSR, means psychosocial rehabilitation group and psychosocial rehabilitation individual. So if an individual person is attending group and also getting some individual PSR, all of those services would count towards their 800 units. Community support group means just that, community support group as it's defined within the rule. It does not include community support individual, and it does not include community support residential services. There are community support residential services that are provided on an individual basis as well as a group basis. Each of those are different and distinct Rule 132 services. Also, as far as the UM program, we will continue to do ACT and CST authorizations. The next point that I wanted to make was that while we did supply medical necessity criteria for community support individual, that service does not require external authorization for this fiscal year utilization management program. As we said in the previous trainings, we've provided medical necessity criteria for services. We expect that providers will use those to inform their practice. Regardless of whether an individual is going to meet that threshold and need authorization or not, the same criteria would apply. But for a community support individual, there is no external authorization process for this fiscal year's utilization management program. As far as the thresholds for utilization management, again, the threshold for therapy counseling is 40 units. And this 40 units includes all three modalities, so individual, group, and family. So if someone is coming in for individual therapy and they're also involved in some group therapy, then all the units of therapy that are billed for that individual are counted towards that 40-unit threshold. For PSR and CSG, again, we have a combined threshold for PSR and CSG, and that combined threshold is 800 units. And units, again, are 15-minute increments for both of those or all three of those services. As far as tracking these thresholds, the tracking of thresholds must be done at the provider level. This is because providers have up to 1 year to submit their claims. And since providers can be submitting claims for up to a year, there's no way for DMH and the collaborative to produce real-time reports for providers on claim submission. This is not reflective of the collaborative not being able to process claims, and I think that was one of the misconceptions out there. This is because we cannot say with any level of certainty to a provider, this is the amount of claims that you have, and therefore we don't want providers to be dependent on us to monitor that, and then they be faced with a situation where they have provided services for which they're not going to get reimbursed because they exceeded the threshold, were not aware they had exceeded the threshold, and then don't have the authorization in place. For submission of authorization requests, providers need to submit requests for authorization in advance of meeting the thresholds for a certain individual if they believe that that individual is going to continue to need services beyond the threshold of units. And the turnaround time for the initial decision on an authorization is 7 business days. So this 7 business days should be included in calculating the timing of submission for authorization decisions. Regarding the electronic authorization request form, there are both required fields and optional fields on the electronic authorization request form. These optional fields are included because they really are meant to provide those collaborative clinical care managers who are going to be making the authorization determinations. They're meant to give them additional information that's commonly considered helpful in providing a more complete clinical picture of an individual. One of those optional fields is the list of medications. It is not required that you provide that list of medications. However, that list of medications can assist the collaborative care managers and the psychiatrists that they may be consulting with if they believe that a service may not be necessary, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. Those lists of medications are one of those things that can be very helpful in assisting them in determining if this is the appropriate service. And the medically necessary service. Also related to the electronic authorization request, the LPHA in your agency does not have to be the person making the authorization request. Providers may request as many usernames and passwords as they would like to for using the Provider Connect system. If a provider wants to limit access for claim submission, because Provider Connect is also the system where providers submit those claims, if they want to limit that to only select staff, they can do that. The form that you complete to request access for the submission of authorizations has a checkbox that says that you want the person to also have access to submit claims. So if you don't want the person to have access to submit claims, you don't check that box. In addition to completing the electronic authorization form, as you're aware, there is supporting documentation that needs to be sent in with the request. And this documentation needs to be sufficient to document both medical necessity for the continued service as well as the individual making progress in treatment. So this is the reason why, while we require mental health assessments and current treatment plans to be submitted, we also expect that in many cases, additional documents will also be sent. Those additional documents may include something like some progress notes, some type of treatment summary, or other clinical documentation or summary written by a clinician involved in the person's care. It does not have to be the LPHA. It can be someone providing the care that will show that the individual is making progress in treatment, that they're involved in their treatment, and also that the treatment continues to be necessary and is addressing identified needs and assisting them in reaching their goals. The supporting documentation can be attached electronically at the time that the authorization request is completed, or it can be faxed to the collaborative, and I've listed the number there. It's also available on the collaborative website, 866-928-7177. When you fax documents, you need to send them under separate cover sheets for each individual. And you need to clearly indicate the individual's name and the service or services being requested for authorization that you want those documents to be considered for that request. All of these documents need to be sent within one business day of completion of the electronic form so that they can be considered as part of the initial determination decision. We did have some discussion on both of the previous webinars about why this particular policy decision was made. We need to make sure that we respond in as timely a manner as we can to all authorization requests. And if a clinical care manager gets an electronic request into their queue, but then they don't have the supporting documentation, it backs up other authorization requests that are sent, and it slows down the process for everyone. So this one business day to send this documentation is meant to make the process as quick as possible for all agencies involved. As far as determining authorizations, the collaborative clinical care managers will consider all the clinical evidence submitted in the documents. They will use the published medical necessity criteria and guidance to guide them in their decision making. And they will authorize services that are demonstrated to be medically necessary. In situations where the clinical care manager believes medical necessity is not indicated, the clinical care manager will then consult with a collaborative psychiatrist to determine whether to authorize the request. And a determination to deny an authorization can only be made by the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist must be licensed to practice in Illinois and must be a board-certified psychiatrist. As far as our medical necessity criteria and guidelines, the guidelines were written with the intention of being broad enough to allow for the exercise of clinical judgment and flexibility as new treatment practices emerge. Nothing within them is meant to preclude the provision of medically necessary services to any particular group of individuals who do have a diagnosis of mental illness. And one of the things that I found interesting in the comments that we've received so far is we've had comments that say the medical necessity criteria are too vague and too broad, to the medical necessity criteria are too detailed. So we really worked many, many hours on determining the medical necessity criteria, and our focus really was on providing enough information to provide direction, but allow for that clinical judgment to occur, because we recognize that the clinicians in practice are exercising their clinical judgment, and we recognize that the clinicians that are doing the determinations are going to be exercising clinical judgment. Again, the collaborative care managers will not deny authorization of any specific service based solely on an individual's diagnosis. This is another misperception from the previous webinars. There were several people who believed that what was said in the webinar was that therapy counseling would not be authorized for an individual with schizophrenia, or that therapy counseling was not an appropriate service. for an individual with schizophrenia. That is not what was said in the previous webinar. What we said was it is less common for therapy counseling to be a service modality for someone with a diagnosis of schizophrenia. It was in the course of an example, and what we were saying was that would be a case where you would want to make sure that your documentation was clear on the things, on the goals that were being addressed and the symptoms and the progress that was being made. But we have never instructed the collaborative not to authorize a service based on a diagnosis. We will not be doing that. The collaborative will not be denying authorizations based solely on a diagnosis. We are very aware that there are individuals with many diagnoses for whom therapy is an appropriate treatment, who make progress in treatment, in therapy, and we certainly support that continuing with our providers. Along with medical necessity, another issue that has come up has to do with the diagnosis of mental illness. A diagnosis of mental illness is and has always been required for reimbursement under Rule 132. So when we talk about persons with dual diagnoses, a person with a dual diagnosis either of substance abuse or a dual diagnosis of a developmental disorder will continue to be eligible for services reimbursed by DMH. Consistent with federal Medicaid requirements, services billed to Medicaid must be to address the symptoms related to the diagnosed mental illness. And this list of diagnoses that are eligible for reimbursement from DMH is extensive, and it has not been changed. It remains the same list. So there is no change in this policy. Just from the creation of the medical necessity criteria. This is a Rule 132 requirement. As far as notification of authorization decisions, the collaborative will make their decision related to authorization requests within 7 business days. Those decisions will be posted to Provider Connect when they are made, and letters will also be mailed to the provider's postal address. Notices will not be sent by email. If there is an initial determination to deny an authorization that's made by the psychiatrist, then the provider may request what we call a reconsideration. At the time that a request for reconsideration is filed, additional supporting documentation may also be sent. And that will be considered by the collaborative physician advisor during the review. The physician advisors, again, will be board certified in psychiatry and licensed to practice in Illinois. And the physician advisor reviewing this documentation will not be the same doctor who made the initial determination. The turnaround time for these reviews is 14 days. Any services that the provider provides during a period of request for reconsideration will be eligible for reimbursement by DMH, of course, subject to the provider following the guidelines related to getting that service reimbursed, the documentation, all of that. And finally, there is an appeals process. If the collaborative physician assistant upholds the initial denial determination, then there are appeal processes through the director, and then finally through administrative law, through Health Care and Family Services. At this point, we're going to end the formal presentation, and we're going to open it up to questions. Again, I wanted to remind everyone of who else is on the panel with me to address questions today. In addition to the director and I that you've already heard from, Jackie Manker with Community Services, Dr. Mary Smith, who handles our MIS system and data, Rusty Dennison, who is with Parker Dennison Associates is our consultant, Emily Sherrill, who's the clinical director at the Collaborative, and Dr. Todd Kasdan, who's the medical director at the Collaborative, are all joining me and are available to answer your questions. So, Becca, if you could please again instruct people how to ask questions, and we'll open the lines up at this time.
Thank you. To ask a question at this time, please press star 1, unmute your phone, and record your name when prompted. To withdraw your request, you may press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment for the first response, please. The first question will come from Justine Levesey.
Yeah. We've only submitted one person so far, one client so far, and it was my understanding, you know, the mental health assessment and the ITP comes along, but it's also asking for additional information before anything else has been done. I mean, it's asking for it immediately. And our information here, we have used Word Corel. We've used Word Perfect, and now we're having to change everything over to Microsoft. So this has been a problem. But back to this asking for additional information right away, what is that all about?
Well, Emily, I'll let you answer as well, but as I said, we believe that it will often be the case that in addition to the mental health assessment and the treatment plan, that additional documentation may be necessary in order to show that the person has progressed in treatment since the time that you did that assessment.
And that additional information would be case notes. Is that what you're calling for?
That might be what is within your record. Again, because the division doesn't dictate the types of forms that agencies
okay.
do, it's hard for us to make a blanket statement that you should submit this additional document.
Well,
however, I believe that the system is designed to ask you, to prompt you, are you sending any of these additional things that we need to look for? And I'd like for Emily to talk just a little bit more about that.
Okay.
Yeah, if you choose at the beginning not to upload your documents and save them as secure clinical attachments to the request
mm-hmm.
when you submit electronically,
mm-hmm.
you certainly have the option at the end if say, you have decided that there are additional documents that you are having issues with formatting or you're having a problem uploading them, you can
okay.
certainly say that you would like to fax those instead. And as long as you fax those to us within a business day, those can certainly be combined with your request.
Okay. Well, we have, you know, cover sheets. When we do ITPs, we obviously do a progress report on the cover sheet. And so that, I suppose, would be the additional information you would be looking for to see if they're making progress. I would think that would be more probably important than the case notes. I just want to be able to make sure we're sending the right stuff because this is really time-consuming.
This is Rusty. I think what I'm hearing the division and collaborative staff say is they want you to send to make the judgment of what information you think presents the most thorough case. And it sounds like you've got a summary format that may accomplish that, and if that's the best thing in your judgment, then that's what you should send. Other providers may not have a summary like that, and it may be easier for them to just send case notes. So it's really what's going to put your best case presentation forward.
Okay, thank you.
Jennifer Humbert.
Hi, this is Jennifer from Grand Prairie. A couple of things. First of all, I know there were additional questions that were asked that have not been answered in this webinar, and I'm wondering when the questions and answers will be posted and on which website.
Thanks, Jennifer. Yes, what I did today was I tried to summarize issues from the Q&As, but you are correct. There are about 150 Q&As. There were more than that, but there were duplicate questions asked between the two webinars, as well as duplicates that were sent in following the webinar. Those have been condensed down and are in the process of being posted to the DHS-DMH website. They will be posted at the same location, or they're called related links,
right.
where the other attachment B Q&As are posted. We've had, I think, four sets of Q&As posted for Attachment B for this fiscal year, and they will be posted at that same website.
Okay, and I have a couple other questions which you may or may not be able to answer today. One of the issues that I know was brought up by several people is the idea that, as far as we can tell at this point, we're only able to enter one site code into the authorization. Many of us have multiple sites or have people who work in the community. What do we do when a person is receiving service, the same service, at more than one site?
Emily or Mary, do you want to address that question?
Certainly. This is Emily. What we had talked about, and this is in the question and answers that will be posted as well, but that you would enter your primary service site location.
Okay, and so any other site that we use would then also be authorized
right.
for that service?
Yes, because it's under the agency.
Okay, so especially with community support group, that's really important.
Absolutely.
And then the final question, which is really maybe peculiar to us and a few other agencies out there, but it's really something we need to know. We have a short-term crisis residential program, which is therapy intensive. The average length of stay in the program is 7 days. If we even ask for authorization on day one, as soon as they walk in the door, they'll burn through the threshold hours within the first 2 to 3 days. And we will not know whether they're authorized or not, in most cases, till after they've been gone for at least 3 to 4 days. If there is no possible way to speed up this turnaround time for situations like this. I mean, we've even asked the department about the potential of rolling it into a per diem, but that doesn't seem to be an option at this point.
Yeah, I think that it is, as you said, a unique circumstance, and we probably need to have further discussion specifically with your agency about exactly what the services are that you're providing and the most appropriate way to be reporting and claiming for those services.
Ms. Grand Prairie?
Yes. And I know the question's been brought up many, many times.
Yeah, Jennifer, this is Jackie Manker. Leanne and I will reach out to you.
Okay.
And I also wanted to just add from Jennifer's original question about the Q&As that Jackie is sitting here with me, and we will send the Q&As also out in a communication alert, so you can look for them that way as well.
Okay, thank you.
Demetria Stubbs.
Yes, hi. The first question I have is that will this particular PowerPoint presentation be available sometime soon for us to download, because there were some statistics and some of the graphs were very interesting, and I would like to share those with others in the organization.
Yes, we will be posting that right next to the PowerPoint that was posted on the collaborative website for the November 18th training.
Okay.
And Sean will be taking care of that within the next few days.
Okay. The next question I have is that if we have a consumer, let's say, for instance, is participating in PSR, and they use up the 200-hour threshold. Now, the consumer may also be in another program which does CSG. Now, let's say, for instance, we have caught the consumer. We have put in authorization for additional hours for the PSR, but we may not put it in for the CSG. Will those CSG services be rejected, or once you put that 200-hour threshold request, does it cover both CSG and PSR? And if not, how are you all differentiating between the two?
I want to ask a clarifying question of you, Demetrius. When you say they're getting CSG from another program, do you mean within your own provider agency, or they're receiving CSG from a different provider?
From our agency. I'm sorry. Yeah, from our agency. Yes, correct.
Okay. If an individual is receiving both PSR and CSG from your agency, then the number of units of PSR and the number of units of CSG will both be used to determine when they reach that 800-unit or 200-hour threshold. So if they're receiving CSG as well as PSR, then you're not just going to count the units of PSR. You need to also be counting the units of CSG. And then if they are determined to need to continue with both some PSR services and some CSG services, both of those services need to be requested for authorization.
Okay.
And if you only request authorization for one of those two services and they've reached the threshold amount, then services for the other service would be denied. So you need to make sure that you include them both if you believe that they continue to need both services.
Okay, and one last question is that we're hearing that, and also we've actually experienced that Medicaid is cutting off some of their clients. They're calling it purging.
Medicaid purging.
Has anyone else heard anything about this? And if so, how does it affect the mentally ill population?
This is Dimitri, and I am not familiar with that term at all. I don't know if Director Jones is still with us, and if she's ran across that, but I'm not familiar with any efforts on at least the Division of Mental Health part that we are changing our eligibility for Medicaid at all.
I haven't heard of that. This is Dr. Jones. I haven't heard of that either. I know there's some consideration for looking at what the state should do in terms of presumptive eligibility and making sure that people remain eligible for Medicaid and requiring them to do something about that rather than assuming that they should remain on the rolls. Those are changes that are happening both in the Medicaid authority and through our human capital development program with the local area offices who register people and get them on those entitlements. So what we will do is investigate any changes in those policies and make sure that they're posted on the website also.
Okay, and one last question I have, I'm sorry, is, okay, initially when we first started using the collaborative website to using the value options to submit our services, we had a problem with duplicate services. So we were instructed that we should be bundling services. Now, with bundling services, you have to wait until you have all the services together at one time before you submit them, because if you have services on the same date and we have several locations, you have to get all the information together at one time and submit all services for each day at once, and we have to bundle it. Now, with that being said, we have to wait for an entire month to ensure that we have all the information before we are to submit it, because we don't want to have this duplicate service rejection. Now, with that being said, I'm wondering if we can at least get some type of consideration for a 30-day or 45-day grace period where we can go back and get the authorization, 30 days or 45 days in the rear. Because we have to wait to put those services in, because we've been instructed we have to bundle to eliminate the duplicate service error message that we were receiving in the beginning.
Well, it sounds like, I think I understand what you're talking about, and it sounds like it's because you have multiple sites and it may take your staff a while to get everything reported to you centrally. However, and if we need to talk to you offline to try to figure out, the best approach to that, you are still going to have some way of keeping track of at least how much you know has been provided already. And if it seems like you're getting close to that threshold and you know that a person may be getting services from another location that you haven't heard from yet, you know, you may need to go ahead and start that authorization process. But we may want to take that offline, maybe with your contract manager, and we could do, you know, do some further discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Cheryl Osagira.
Hi. I just have a couple questions. On the authorization form, there's a place that states that you indicate the first date of treatment, and there's been some confusion about, is the first date of treatment the date that the person originally came for therapy or PSR or whatever the service might be, or is it the first day of treatment in the authorization cycle?
Emily, can you clarify the dates of treatment on the authorization form?
Yeah, so are you talking about under the requested services header where
yes.
It says requested start date?
Yes.
Okay, requested start date is the start date of the authorization.
Okay,
so
is there anywhere... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I apologize. Not necessarily the date that the consumer first started treatment, but...
Okay, is there... Go ahead.
The date that the threshold, the hours that you're requesting would begin.
Okay, and is there anywhere on that form, though, that they ask for the first day that the person originally came into treatment, or is there not?
Actually, it's on the requested services header. It's it says date therapy, counseling, community support group, or psychosocial rehabilitation started. So it is
okay,
there. It's right above the field that says clinical staff to contact if questions.
So they want the original date, like if the person started in 1987, that's what they want to know at that point.
But in the requested start date, that is the date that your authorization would begin.
Now, will that impact, like if a person has been in therapy for a long time, we have people that have been in services, day program, whatever, for many, many years, is that going to impact whether a person could potentially be reauthorized for services?
Well, certainly we take everything into account, so we'll be looking at progress in treatment and the whole comprehensive picture with all the documents that you're submitting.
Okay. Also, in CST, they have asked our CST staff sometime to send a summary rather than, along with the treatment plan and mental health assessment, to make it a little bit easier for them to go through it. Is that something that you would want us to do, is along with the mental health assessment and treatment plan, to provide some sort of a summary of services for authorization to make it a little bit easier to go through or not? Because I know for CST they've been asking for that.
This is Emily again. I think certainly that's, again, your agency's choice in what you think
okay.
works for you all. You know, again, we just need the information, so the form that you choose to send it in would be up to you as an agency.
Okay, I just have two more real quick things. One of them, and I don't know if you can answer this or not, is on the PSR documentation. Up to this point, it's become very laborious. You know, the state has been requiring this, you know, in very, very detailed amount of documentation, which has made it very difficult to actually provide treatment. Is there going to be, at some point in the future, any tweaking of the documentation for PSR to make it less cumbersome, or is that something that, you know, that you would know?
Lynn, this is Jackie.
Hi, Jackie.
We do have the revised rule in JCAR right now, and that could certainly be a public comment that you suggest through that process. And we can ask the committee to take a look at it. I don't
yes.
believe we have looked at that. You won't find it in the revised rule, but I think that's a good suggestion and worthy of a reconsideration.
Thank you very much. And just one more real quick thing. When we're doing treatment planning right now, one part of the treatment plan that we have been asked to do is to put down, in the client's words, how long do they think they need to be in treatment, and to be working that out with their clinician or their case manager. How is this whole process going to affect client choice and the whole recovery process?
Well, what I would say is if you read the medical necessity criteria. Client choice is included throughout the medical necessity criteria. We want to make sure that it's one of the very first things under service initiation criteria, I believe, is that it's something that the consumer believes is going to be beneficial and assist them in obtaining their recovery goals. That's one of the reasons why we ask within the medical necessity criteria for and within the authorization process for evidence that they are making progress in treatment and that they believe that this is a service that's appropriate. And certainly that continues to be the case.
Okay, thank you.
Norma Rifflinger.
Hello. I want to follow up on Demetrius's question. So am I understanding it to have been answered this way, that the authorization levels are per provider agency?
That is correct.
All righty. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bonnie Bluestein?
I think that was answering my question, because I was wondering if a consumer comes to our agency and has been at another agency or maybe multiple agencies during that authorization period, how would we, you know, we wouldn't know how many hours or anything like that.
Exactly, and that's the reason why the thresholds are provider specific.
It would just like
a way for you to know that.
It would just start all over again once they came to our agency.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Connie Kinshelter.
Hi, this is Connie Tischhauser from Leiden Family Service and Mental Health Center. And my question, if Dr. Jones is there, I'd like to direct it towards her. And it's really in regards to the establishment of these thresholds, because it seems to me, and I'm certainly not a researcher, but that you're using averages, which means that you have people that have, you know, come once or twice, that you really don't know what has happened to them, and saying, using that as sort of then the people that use more are the outliers. So that seems to me problematic in a way if you think about outcomes. And I wonder if it was ever considered to try to get a sample of people in state-operated facilities in checking some usage of services when you want to talk about authorizations that are needed. Or even considering looking at these 800, I'm just talking about the PSR, the 896 outliers that are using, you know, the 25% or 75% of the money. So it seems to me that the establishment of the thresholds has some problems in terms of, because you're not really even thinking about outcomes in a sense. So...
Well, thank you for your question, and we're always most interested, of course, in outcomes and want to support consumers' recovery in any way possible. And just as a reminder, any consumer who continues to need treatment and will meet the obligations pursuant to medical necessity will not be denied care. So... And there is the way that these thresholds are established is by looking at a large population, an enormous amount of data, aggregating that data and performing statistical analysis on that data to see what's within kind of an average range and what is outside that average range. I think that we have some staff on the line now who can speak more, or consultants who can speak more to the methodology that we used to establish the thresholds. I want, as a reminder, you to know that there are several things that other options that we did not take, such as establishing hard limits for people, which is another option that many states and other systems do. So the fact that we use thresholds does allow us to consider the individual needs of consumers, and if we have some assurances that the individual continues to need that service, that they will have that service. And so I'll turn it over to perhaps Jackie or Rusty, who can talk more about the methodology. Again, the other thing that I want to note is that that people are expected to make progress while they're in this service. It's supposed to be time limited, rehabilitative, and they are supposed to make progress. So the intent is not for them to stay in this service forever. There are some gaps in our system so that people who have, particularly people who have been institutionalized for a long period of time, have, you know, socialization needs and things like that. And so we do, as a system, understand that we have to find ways to fill in those gaps and give people something to do with their time. But this specific service is driven by a curriculum that is designed to create an improvement in their lives, improvement in their daily living skills and their capacity to function independently. And when there's no longer improvement that's being made, then some other options need to be looked at for them. So let me turn this over to Jackie or Rusty and have them explain more about the methodology that we used to define the threshold.
Well, I'll just make a couple comments. This is Rusty. I think it's very important to understand that the state is not using averages. That's not really an accurate statement at all. We use a series of frequency distributions to get at the threshold. So, because averages would have been grossly distorting because of these huge outliers that we had, as Leanne discussed during her presentation. So it was not averages. I think the other discussion that is useful for people to know is that at the we've been talking more about the outliers from an overutilization, but I think that it's fair to say that the state has equal concerns about potential underutilization when you look at frequency distribution. For example, in therapy counseling, there's a large representation of individuals that received 1 to 3 contacts or units of therapy counseling. And I think that it begs the question, is there a problem or a barrier to accessing services appropriately? However, to really get at that information, the state would have had to require authorization of 100% of services starting from the beginning of services to be able to identify that, and that was just an unreasonable administrative burden. Future efforts, as you evolve your utilization management system, you really should be doing some sampling of those underutilization situations and doing some follow-up case reviews to see what's going on there. But in the interest of trying to limit administrative costs to the system at this point, focusing on the overutilization outlier seemed like the best place to get a return on investment for the system.
So could you, on the frequency distribution, I may not understand that exactly, but you used like groupings of one number to another number of, and then is that what you meant?
Correct.
And then out of that?
And then out of that, set the threshold so that we and this is for a first-year threshold, as with any system, it should evolve, saying that there was a natural gap in intensity of service at that 75th threshold, and the state decided not to set it at average, which would have been at a 50% threshold, but rather to set it at 75%, to just assume that 75% was appropriate utilization and that the gap jumping to the 25% of the higher utilizers was really going to be the first year data that you all would look at more intensely. As you get experience with that, you may find that threshold needs to either go up or down to really capture those cases that are truly problematic. So, for example, if after a time period, a year or more of doing these reviews, you find that, yes, there was reviews done on 25% of the population, but of those 25% that was reviewed, only 10% actually were denied. The rest of them were approved. Well, that would suggest that the threshold could probably be set higher. Conversely, if you saw a high denial rate or a high not reauthorizing rate in that percentage, that might suggest that the threshold needs to drop lower in future years. And that's why the program needs to continue to look at the data, continue to look at the outcomes of the review process, and adjust as more information comes in and experience with the system comes in.
Okay, I have one more question then. Thank you very much for that explanation. And that's in it's in the letter from Jackie Menker that's dated January 3rd. And so if you're there, I think that, Jackie, that in the second paragraph it says, because these amendments are only intended to codify the implementation, so forth, there will be no change to the DHS certification or post-payment review processes until the proposed rule amendments are adopted and then if new interpretive guidelines are produced and training on the revised rules held late in the spring of 2011. Could you explain that? Does that mean that these are, is how that ties into these authorizations? I was trying to figure that out.
Yes, thanks. The state needed to codify in statute our ability to do authorization, to do utilization management. That is what we submitted through emergency rule. And I've got my Medicaid expert here, who's Kathy Cumston, will say, correct me if I say anything wrong. So that was our sole intention in filing the emergency rule, was to allow us to do utilization management. At the same time, well, I might just stop here and ask Kathy to explain it. So, go ahead.
Hi, this is Kathy Cumston. There had been some concerns raised that with very little notice, the department was going to start expecting that providers needed to do different types of documentation and have different information available in their records for certification surveys or for post-payment review surveys. And so this is just to clarify that we are not going to expect that. The guidelines for surveys have not changed, and they will not be approaching you any differently than they have been.
So that means, and there were some differences in the utilization management requirements, like things like that. Is that what you mean?
Yes. And the only reason that those are there is to clarify what will be done with utilization management, not with certification or post-payment review.
Thank you.
Welcome.
John Morgan.
Hi. I think, you know, we're all interested in trying to make the process as efficient as possible, and I think that most providers probably have their assessments and their treatment plans in some kind of electronic format, but not many of us are at a point where we're digitally signing those things. And I was wondering if you could consider adding a checkbox to the request form that would, where the provider would certify that the required signatures are in file.
I think that is a good suggestion and something that we will discuss with the collaborative, you know, ways that we might be able to do that. We've certainly had similar discussions with our ACT and CST authorizations because we do check for signatures at the time that we come out and do post-payment reviews. So we do realize that there are times when that's a challenge. So let us go back and discuss that. We're writing it down and making a note of it, and also this is being transcribed for us. So we will follow up on that.
Thank you. I think it would be very helpful, and even if it's for a time-limited period, to give us a little extra time to move our technology forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
Julie Rodriguez.
Yes, my question was regarding a recent dialogue. I heard that it's a possibility that because this authorization process is a way to access and link the clients to services, that it could be billed as a case management service. Is that correct?
Sorry, I mute myself when you're talking, and then I couldn't get myself unmuted. Yes, we've put that into the Q&As that the activities that you do that are linking an individual with their entitlement do fall under the mental health case management definition within the service definition reimbursement guide, and that is in the Q&As and will be coming out, as we said, in a communication alert and also posted to the web.
Okay, thank you. And also, as a back to that, for CSP participants, typically case management type services are under the CSP code, and they don't bill case management mental health. Will that be allowed for CSP billing as well?
You're asking if you can bill community support team for completing that service, is that what you're asking?
Well, I'm just wondering if we should bill case management.
Provided.
Suppose CST, sure. It's just that CST has not been able to bill for that in the past, and I'm wondering how that will be allowed now. Under what code?
You would bill the service that you're providing, and I'm not sure if you're saying that you've not billed case management for someone who receives community support team.
Right.
ACT is the only service that you're not allowed to bill other Rule 132 services. You're not allowed to bill the other community support services for community support team, but there's nothing within the rule that prevents you from billing other Rule 132 services for an individual receiving CST.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
And this is Rusty. Just to make sure that there was a clarification on that billing, I think it also should be really clear that providers should not be in a situation where they're billing for support staff time to fax documents and do documents on the computer, that it really needs to be the clinical process of summarizing and communicating the information necessary to link the benefit, but it's not for administrative activities. I think if you do administrative activities, you're open to pretty aggressive federal audit risk.
Thank you, Rusty.
Raymond Mays?
Yes. How are you?
Okay, I got to go. I'm in a meeting.
When we are billing for community support, residential, individual, and or groups, and it's authorized on-site Medicaid facility. This does not fall under the medical necessity piece, does it, or does it not?
It does not fall under community support group that you would need to monitor the threshold for utilization for this utilization management program.
Okay, thank you.
Jean Zuby.
Hello. I still had a question about those agencies in South Cook that are suburban Cook that are participating in the pilot. Are we going to be required to utilize this utilization management plan until the HMOs are up and running and develop their own, or are we exempt entirely?
If you are receiving reimbursement from DMH for the individual, then that individual's care is subject to DMH's UM program. If you are receiving reimbursement from one of the MCOs, the managed care pilots managed care organizations within the integrated care pilot, then you would be subject to whatever policies that they publish. But
so you're not exempt. This is Jackie, and you as long as DMH is reimbursing you for services, then it does fall under our UM program.
Okay, thank you.
Mamie Robinson.
Hi, I needed clarity regarding the thresholds calculations for FY11. I just wanted to make sure, according to the conference call in November, you indicated that the starting date was January 3rd. That was the date that we started calculating the units, and that's from January 3rd through June 30th. That will cover FY 2011, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and after that, July 1st through June 30th of 2013?
That would be fiscal year 12.
Okay.
And we, as Rusty said, one of the things that you do with utilization management is you continue to look at the data, and so, you know, we still have to, within DMH, have discussions about where we will set thresholds for 2012.
Okay.
But,
so,
and you know, we will be working with stakeholders, with providers, in determining, you know, where we set those thresholds for 2012. We may leave it the same because this is, you know, we got a late start.
Right.
Or we may make adjustments, as Rusty said, depending on what we see with the data. It's just too early at this point in time to say.
Okay, but for 2011, it does not start until this past Monday, which was January 3rd. That's when
right.
we start calculating the units.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Sandra Vilbach. Sorry, one moment while I reopen her line, please. Andrew, your line is open.
Hi. I had a question. It says that the UM program only covers the Medicaid services reimbursed by DHS and not SAS. We're a program 120, and sometimes when a client is in SAS but not receiving SAS services, we bill HFS. Those would not count in the threshold. Is that correct, because we're billing HFS?
That is correct. Only services reimbursed by DMH.
Okay. That was my one question. The next, it's more of a comment or a request that we've been having a lot of difficulty once this 90-day registration rule went into effect, where you know, errors occur, someone enters the registration date wrong, like putting the date they're doing the form instead of backdating it, putting the registration date, and not catching it until months later on the billing cycle when the bill has been rejected. And then there's no way to fix that registration date because the 90 days have expired. We've had several instances of that and then lost billing. I've brought it up on the monthly TA call, and I've even had, like, email correspondence with Karen Vendetti, and they said it's a policy question, so I don't know if other providers are having this. The other thing is that if we have a year to bill for services, I don't understand the need for the 90-day time frame to go back and set the registration date. The other thing is with these SAS cases, sometimes, you know, clients come out of SAS on a certain day, and maybe we're missing the exact day. So then, again, months later, we find that the 2 days that are in discrepancy between the, when they left SAS and when they were with us, and we put the registration, were incorrect. And then, again, we're losing the billing. So I don't know if something could be done about that. Or, and I have several, you know, instances of, you know, it's thousands of dollars for our agency. So I would like to have that go on record and maybe have some reconsideration of that policy.
Thanks for your comments. And as I said earlier, we will get all of this in transcription, so it will be documented. And I believe Dr. Mary Smith is still on the line. I don't know, Mary, if you want to say anything further about the 90-day registration issues at this point or not.
Well, the only thing I would remind people is that you do have, you know, I think what you're talking about in your agency is a quality control issue. You know, I understand that people make errors, but it seems to me that we've put reports out there so that folks can take a look at information. And, you know, this is, I think, one of the things that you should address in your agency.
Well, and it's not the ERIN issue. I mean, that's okay. It's just, again, if we have a year to bill, why can't we have that same time frame for the registrations?
DMH uses registration information for lots of things. We use some of the information as part of the utilization management research that Leanne described today. We try to use, you know, the registration information for federal reporting and lots of other things within the division. And so what we need providers to do is report that information in a timely way. And so, you know, I think actually with the utilization management program going into effect, you're always going to be better off to go ahead and get your registration in ASAP. And so it really, you know, I think you're actually at a disadvantage if you don't get that in.
I mean, the majority we do, but I just would like to see some kind of sounding board for exceptions when there are mistakes like that that are made. We're not looking to have not submit all our registrations until a year later, that we wouldn't be getting any money that way. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Amy Redmore?
I'm wondering how the mental health intensive outpatient program, the modality is impacted by this.
As I said during the presentation, Rule 132 contains definitions for many specific, distinct services. Mental health intensive outpatient is a distinct service. It is not a service identified for the utilization management program at this point in time, so it is not affected by the utilization management program.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Susan Lachbaum? Please check your mute button.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry, I got the wrong button there. I have a couple of questions from our team. And the first one has to do, if you have an individual that is duly funded, and that would be Medicare and Medicaid, does that have any impact on the number of units?
No, it does not, and this is a question that's included in the Q&As. We are talking about the units of service which you report for reimbursement to DMH. So it's not based on the amount of money that is paid. It's based on the amount of units reimbursed. So once you get to 40 units of therapy counseling that you have claimed for DMH reimbursement, even if there is another payor, that 40 units will trigger the need for that authorization to be in place if you're going to continue to claim units for therapy counseling. Same with PSR and CSG once you get to 800 units.
Okay, thank you. Another question is, will the lack of community or natural supports, we're a very small rural community, if somebody has a dysfunctional family or whatever, will those kinds of things be taken into consideration when authorizing additional units?
Well, again, I think Dr. Jones talked about this earlier in response to a question. We certainly recognize that there are holes within the system, and it's something that we want to work collaboratively to address, but we have to be very, very careful when we are putting things through for federal match Medicaid that those services are actually the Medicaid services, meaning that they actually are medically necessary. And so certainly if there are some challenges for an individual in accessing their natural supports and they need some additional time and community support to access them, that's one thing. But if they just don't exist and so we're providing them with a Medicaid service because a natural support doesn't exist, then that's another issue that exposes all of us to risk, and we need to be looking at that and having some dialogue about what is the more appropriate thing to be doing and developing. A lot of that has to do with helping individuals to develop the natural supports within a community that are not provider-based, that aren't anything to do with Medicaid services, but things like faith-based organizations and libraries and those things that exist in communities. And I realize that depending on the community, even those are, limited. But we have to be very cognizant of what our risks are if we're providing a service that is for a reason other than medical necessity.
Okay, thank you. And the last question.
This is Dr. Jones. Let me add on to that. Thank you, Leanne. That was a very complete answer. But for particularly rural areas, but for all providers in general, if this seems to come up quite a bit, where you want to make sure that people have activities and you're, you know, fairly certain that they don't qualify any longer for a Medicaid service, then take that information to your regions, to your regional executive directors, who have a responsibility to bring in a number of partners, not just mental health, not just primary health care, but to bring together a number of partners so you and your communities can figure out what other resources, natural supports, can be made available. So you're broadening your range of providers, of agencies, of entities that can play a role in the consumer's recovery.
Thank you, Dr. Jones.
You're welcome.
The last question the team had was, if there is someone who is going to require more than 40 units, and that might include the need for a reassessment, would a second assessment be paid for within the time frame? Right now it's 6 months. Next year it will be a year.
Again, assessment, mental health assessment, I assume is what you're talking about. Mental health assessment is a separate service under Rule 132.
Correct.
So that is not included in the threshold amount.
So that's right. So another one, if necessary, could be done.
Correct.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Doug Hotchkiss?
Hi. My questions are primarily in view of trying to help with my agencies to keep down the cost of these authorizations and making everything as efficient as we can. So I was wondering, has there been any thought given, because I know this came up in the other webinars, to auto-populating more of the screens that are where people put in these authorizations, because a lot of that data is required to register the clients, and in fact, we keep it current every 6 months when we re-register them.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, and we actually had some discussion about that this past week. And I think that to the extent that it's possible, that we will certainly work toward that. I know that we would have to negotiate this with the people that operate the IT systems, but, you know, in an effort to try to reduce the redundancy in data entry and things like that, it's certainly worth pursuing. So I certainly understand that concern, and we will work internally to see what can happen. Mary, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I thank you, Dr. Jones.
Okay.
Okay.
But it could be complicated given the IT systems, but we understand the intent and we'll certainly do what we can.
Okay, good. That's good to hear. The other one, this is maybe, I'm sure there may be some clinical reasons for this, but it would certainly make life easier technically and administratively. Initially on the thresholds, the services are essentially getting bundled, like the three modalities of therapy and counseling, for example. But when we actually have to ask for a authorization, we have to get more granular and specify how much of each, which on our end means essentially putting in three separate authorizations when we, if assuming they're approved. If assuming the client also is receiving the multiple, you know, services, is any thought been given to allowing authorizations to go forward in a bundled fashion? Just like they're going to get reset every July 1 anyway, is my understanding.
Emily, do you want to address how a provider requests therapy authorization if they're doing a combination of modalities?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, sir, I heard that the concern was more about needing three separate requests because you're specifically asking for units of service for each of the modalities of therapy counseling, correct?
Right.
Okay, so in the request form, you are doing that. You're letting us know your idea, what you're requesting, what you think you might use for each of those modalities. However, when we do the actual authorization,
mm-hmm.
it will be for the total bundled therapy counseling. That gives providers a little bit more freedom to determine what may be more necessary. So, you know, initially when you send your request in, you may feel that a consumer needs more individual therapy rather than group, but then come to find out as you meet with the consumer, they seem to be needing more group. So this allows the leeway. So you are actually letting us know at the beginning what you are requesting. You'll get a total number of units, however, authorized.
Okay, so if I were to ask for 10 units of therapy and 10 units a group, and you granted me 20 units, but it ends up that I use 15 units a group and 5 units of therapy, that's okay?
Yes.
As long as I stay within the 20.
Yes, the approval is actually for therapy counseling as a service.
Oh, well, I'm sure glad I asked that question.
Okay.
Affects my own designs. Okay, good. Well, my last question is, taking efficiency to its ultimate, since virtually everything you want on these authorization forms we're storing in our databases anyway, has any thought been given to treating this like we do batch registrations and sending the entire thing electronically rather than having to double entry this all into your website?
Doug, it's Mary Smith. We have that suggestion's been made by a couple of people, and so we'll be looking at that in the future. We can't do it now, but that doesn't rule it out for the future.
Okay, that would help. That would help a lot in terms of this. You know, there's some agencies are looking at hiring the better part of a full-time person just to do staff support for these things. Okay, thank you.
Sue Warwick.
Hi there. Yes, I just have a couple questions. It was made mentioned that this service that we are going to be provided for pre-authorizations would be billable. Do you know how many units that would be?
It would be whatever time you're spending with the individual in determining their need for continued service and assisting them in getting that entitlement. So, you know, it's not a separate service. It's case management mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So you would, and it's billed in units. And so it would be determined by what your staff person needed to do on an individual basis with a person.
Okay. The other question, somebody else had made mention about the documents not having signatures. We currently have our signatures encrypted already in our system because they're electronic. And so if we upload our documents, they will not show. Is that okay? Or
Emily, can you speak to how you currently handle encrypted signatures that are uploaded electronically?
Yeah, I don't know that we've had the issue of encrypted signatures. What I do know is that we do accept electronic signatures of the clinicians. So if an agency does have a lot of electronic signatures that show on their plans, those are certainly acceptable.
Right, and so when I'm looking at the documents, what we've done is we've uploaded them into a PDF file, and because they're considered original documents and already encrypted in our system, they won't show, so they look blank if I was to upload them to your system, as if the signatures weren't there. But in actuality, they're electronic signatures.
Can you give me your name and your agency again? Because I think probably what we need to do is follow up with you separately. We may need to get some arrangement for you to give us some verification that those documents are signed within your system, but I think we need to probably work offline to do that.
Okay. Sue, S-U-E, Warwick, W-A-R-W-I-K, and this is Resurrection Behavioral Health ProCare Centers. And then did you want me to give you my number now, or?
Or who's your contract manager?
Sorry to say that I don't know that.
Okay. You can give me your number. That's fine.
708-81-0073, and then my extension is 5225.
You know, okay. what region are you in?
Region 1.
Okay.
And Sue, I missed one of your numbers. I have 708-81-0073.
708-681? 81.
Okay.
Another question is, the signatures, as I indicated, are encrypted. However, I don't know that all of our documents are encrypted prior to us uploading them. Because your system is already secured, do we have to make sure that everything is encrypted prior to uploading them to your website?
No, you wouldn't need to. As you upload them, they are attached securely to the request.
Okay, very good. The other question, and I think it was answered already, it was made mention that as of January 3rd, we already have the 40 units pre-approved for the group or individual therapy, and I just wanted to make sure that initial mental health assessments, locus, and treatment planning is not counted in those 40 units, that those indeed are separate services and are not counted against the 40 units. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct.
Can you also let me know the limitation of how many hours can be completed in a year for the mental health assessment?
There is no there are no limits for any Medicaid service, okay? There are no limits for those Rule 132 services. There are thresholds for the services we've described. And there are the two services that require authorization prior to the provision of the service, ACT and CST. The rest of the services do not have any thresholds for authorization, and they don't have limits, but there has to be the appropriate documentation. They have to be delivered according to the rule provisions for that service. So there's nothing that says, you can provide, you know, a certain number of units of mental health assessment for an individual who is enrolled in Medicaid.
Okay, I just want to clarify because I know in the eligibility criteria package that has been limited.
Right, and remember, it's very important, and I know it can be confusing because both of these things happened within the same fiscal year. The eligibility packages for those other three groups, the non-Medicaid groups, are for individuals that are not enrolled in Medicaid. And those individuals do have benefit packages with limits on them. But again, those individuals are individuals without Medicaid. Individuals with Medicaid have the full array of Rule 132 services available to them. And individuals with Medicaid are subject to the thresholds for the utilization management program. So you have to keep those two groups separated in your mind.
Okay, thank you. That's all.
Thank you.
Michael Hurd.
Good afternoon. I'm calling. I wanted to ask a question regarding the information that's on page 46 of the PowerPoint and refer to the medical necessity criteria and guidance manual on number 2, lowercase d. It clearly says that you can use the Ohio scale. And it appears that you could use both pages of the Ohio scale, the severity as well as the functioning scales. But on page 46 of the presentation, I guess this is what you would submit, it reads Ohio scale, Ohio problem severity scale for youth ages 17. It has service initiation, which means... Well, it says service initiation all and current if in services more than 90 days. So what number are we supposed to be submitting?
If the individual has been in service for less than 90 days, then you are entering one score. If they've been in service for over 90 days, you're updating the score. That is how the registration works. For our children and adolescents with those functional scales. That's how they are reported within that system. I don't know, Mary or Emily, if you want to add anything further to that.
It's Mary. No, that's true. And there are two scale scores for the Ohio scale.
Right, and you can conceivably use either page, because if you look at the functioning scale, if a kid, for example, getting along with friends, if they score zero, and that's related to what's on their treatment plan, you want them to go from extreme troubles to doing well or doing okay, which is a three or a four. But again, to me, it's sort of vague or not clear, because it clearly says here, Ohio Problem Severity Scale, which is different from the functioning scale. So if I'm looking at what the score is, I'm not sure which one. I don't want this to count against me in terms of the number I put down or the accuracy of me recording these numbers.
Are you saying that you would not have a score on one of the subscales?
Yes, I would have a score. Okay, when I record these numbers at another website, they're recorded. Two different numbers are recorded. The severity scale is recorded, and the functioning scale is recorded. It's not combined. So
I understand what you're saying. As far as I know, I don't have it up in front of me. And Emily, if you have it up in front of you, you may want to comment. But as far as I recall, we're actually requiring both of those subscale scores.
So you
we're
want
not just requiring one.
Right.
It's the total.
Okay. All right. So I'm for you guys. I'm supposed to add the severity as well as the functioning scale.
You know, what we'll do is, again, as Leanne said, you know, where all of this is being recorded, we'll post an answer to that for you so that it's clear.
Right, and that will be posted where?
Today's audio recording. Yeah, I can answer that. Right. Today's
Thank
audio
you.
Recording will be posted on the provider information page of the Collaborative's website.
Okay.
It'll be under the provider resources heading. It's the same location as where you will find the Monday, the monthly Monday TA call audio recordings as well.
Right. And just for clarity, again, we already are, you know, accruing this data, and I have to put this data at another website. And historically what's been happening is that I record one page of this, one number comes up, I go to the next set of questions or next set of statements, I record those numbers, and two separate numbers come up. And conceivably, several statements from severity as well as the functioning scale can be utilized on a treatment plan, either to decrease the number or increase the number. So if someone could get, you know, back with me about that, I'd appreciate it. Again, I guess you said I could go to this website. The other question, this is coming up to me since we've been on this question and answer, the Q&A, and I'm not sure if you guys can answer this question. One, community support individual, there's no threshold on that, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, what's the difference? And again, you guys may not be able to answer this. What's the difference between community support individual and, let's say, therapy?
They are two distinct services defined by Rule 132 with distinct activities. And if you need to, look at the rule for further definition, I would encourage you to do that. But they are specifically defined services.
Right. This is sort of a rhetorical question. So conceivably an agency, if we're working with individuals, if we're working with kids, if we're working with adolescents in a setting that they need to have one-on-one contact to address specific behavior, the community support individual could be used for that?
If it meets the rule definition.
Right, if it meets the rule 132.
You can't just call something a different service.
I understand that.
Up in post-payment review.
Right, I understand that. I have the Rule 132 that I can refer to. Okay, I just have to refer back. But please look into this, because this is critical for me in terms of what's on what I have to submit. I'd really like that to be, clarified.
Okay.
Can we make sure we have your name and agency? Can you give that to me, please?
Michael Heard, H-E-A-R-D, Miles Square Community Mental Health Center. And my direct number is 312-850-5811.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Ben Stortz?
Yes, this is Ben Stortz with Cornerstone, and two questions. My first is, at Cornerstone, we serve a number of people with serious mental illness, and they receive a variety of supports from us, including PSR and therapy and counseling and residential services. And I am somewhat concerned about the thresholds that are established in that if people are not reauthorized with us, I fear some people will relapse and we'll see an increase in hospitalizations. We're able to decrease psychiatric hospitalizations by 96% here. And I'm just curious if any consideration is given to the population served or the nature of a disability of a person.
Well, again, I'm glad to hear that you're monitoring. It sounds like you're doing some outcome monitoring and seeing effectiveness of your programs, and that is certainly what we as a division want to see providers doing. And certainly the intention of a utilization management program is never to cause people to relapse. The real focus of utilization management is to make sure that the services being provided are effective and that people are moving towards their recovery goals. And so certainly we will continue to look at that, and as we have said earlier on in the presentation and in other answers, utilization management involves ongoing analysis and reconsideration of, you know, a variety of variables, the thresholds, who needs to be authorized, what services need to be authorized. So certainly we'll continue to look at that. But it is also important not to just assume that because a person has a serious persistent mental illness that they should go on and on and on in perpetuity in a specific service. And so all of that we have to look at, you know, as a system.
Yeah, so my second question, I know it was alluded to on this call and in the previous ones, you have referred to other services that might be available if you felt that these weren't working, and what services are you considering?
Well, what I'm talking about would be, you know, if someone is going to the same curriculum-based PSR classes over and over and over, you would assume that at some point in time they would develop the skills that curriculum is based on. And so then, you know, community support was discussed just a few minutes ago. It may be that the person needs some individual community support to help them to generalize those skills to settings outside of that facility-based, classroom-based place of instruction. And so they may need more community support than they're getting. But again, it's really hard to give examples without ending up getting myself into trouble because people mishear me and think I said that someone with a diagnosis of schizophrenia should never get therapy, which is not what I said. You know, it's really hard on these calls to give very specific examples, and that's why utilization management is done on an individual basis, clinically focused, reviewed by licensed clinicians.
Yeah, I understand. I was just curious to know what services you might consider because it was alluded to a couple of times, so I didn't know if there was new services that the department was considering.
No, not at this time.
The next question will come from Ed Marston.
Hi, this is Ed Marston. I'm a privacy officer, and clinically I work closely with child and adolescent teams. And my concern is about faxing the comprehensive mental health assessment to the collaborative. By virtue of 132 requirements and accreditation standards, the MHA contains considerable amount of protected health information belonging not only to the child but also to the parents and other family members. You know, that might include parents' health history, our current health status, mental health history, current treatment, quality of the home environment, and so on. And the scope of all that really goes beyond the current consent process by which families agree to allow us to bill their services to the state. So, you know, the HIPAA principle is, of course, the minimum necessary information to get the job done. So my question is whether the department has considered whether the UM process as designed, whether it meets the minimum necessary standard.
Mary, I'm not sure if you want to, you know, add to this or not. And Emily, I certainly would appreciate your input as far as what safeguards are in place for privacy and that type of thing. But what I can say is that we have been doing other utilization management since 2008 that does require the faxing of or electronic submission if providers are capable of doing that, of a number of protected health information pieces of material that is within our ASO, within their functions that they do for us as the division. We have a business associate arrangement with them, which means that they are basically an arm of DMH. They are functioning for us and so have the rights to see that information in order to complete the business that we've directed them to complete. I don't know, Jackie, if you want to add.
And Leanne, this is Rusty. The other thing I would point out is that prior to starting the original authorization for ACT and CST, there was extensive legal review, both with attorneys through the collaborative, but with state attorneys on the scope and compliance with all aspects of HIPAA. And the determination was that it was by all the legal staff was that it was well within the rights for the exchange of information and the methodologies that had been identified.
I think I just probably add to that I think that with children and families, there are some special considerations that may not have been on the table in those kind of discussions. Again, information pertaining not to the patient, but to non-patients, parents and other family members. But let me move beyond that and also say, because we are going to have a different kind of consent process with our children and families, I think in order to accomplish this task, what should we tell families about how long the information we give to the collaborative, about how long it will be retained and how it will be disposed of?
I don't know that. I think that's a very good question, and I don't know that we have an answer for you right now. Emily, if you guys do, please speak up. But I think that is a very good question, and that's something that we need to give guidance to the collaborative and then publicize a response to that.
Okay, thanks for...
Yeah, and could I... What's your name and agency? I may want to tap into your knowledge in this area.
Yeah, this is Dr. Ed Marston, M-A-R-S-T-O-N. I'm with Grand Prairie Services.
Okay, thank you, Ed.
And I'm also here with Dr. Ron Weiglars, and he's got a separate kind of question.
Okay.
Hi, I have two just basic practical questions. One is, if a client comes in and we treat them under the 10 sessions and they finish their treatment, we don't have to ask for authorization. But if that client returns 2 months later, do they get another 10 sessions or are in the initial registration, we have to count those as towards their free sessions or accepted sessions?
If an individual has... if you have submitted claims for reimbursement for 40 units within a fiscal year and the individual you believe is going to need more units, then you do have to get those authorized before you can provide them. As someone was saying earlier, if you believe you've completed therapy with them, let's say, and you've terminated therapy and you close their case and they come back, then you're most likely going to need to do some assessment to begin with anyway. You're going to need to have a discussion with them about and assess
what those current needs are if you terminated therapy with them and you thought that treatment was done. You're going to need to assess them anyway. And mental health assessment and treatment planning are separate, distinct Rule 132 services. So certainly in those cases, if that were appropriate, then you could do, you know, more assessment with them and do treatment planning. And in the process, if you believe they're going to need more sessions of therapy, then you would complete that authorization as you're, you know, doing the mental health assessment service and the treatment planning service.
So the within a fiscal year, you mentioned, so if I used only 5 or 10 of the 40 sessions, well, I should say units, at that point, then I only have 30 units left. I'm going to have to get authorization pretty quickly if I feel I'm going to use them quickly.
Yes. As I said in the presentation, you want to keep track and you want to request the authorization with enough time that you have that decision prior to using that 40th unit. And there's that 7-day
okay.
business day turnaround time for the collaborative. So you want to calculate
sure.
that in as well. So you wouldn't want to wait until they're there for their
sure.
10th hour and then say, oh, we better do some authorization here.
Okay, so I understand that. The second question is just a follow-up to this, is after I see a client, I do get authorization and say I get 20 more sessions, they drop out of therapy, and then they come back 6 months later, those 20 sessions are, even though I close them out and I'm reopening them again for another segment of treatment, those 20 that I got authorized already, would those be counting or am I back to the 40 units to begin with and looking for reauthorization?
Well, if it's 6 months later, then we're out of this current fiscal year. And
okay.
So then we're looking at FY12 and the utilization management for FY12. And as I said, we haven't yet determined what those thresholds will be for FY12.
Very good.
And this is Jackie. I think I see where you're going. And when we do get there, we need to consider the registration case closing
mm-hmm.
and the impact that might have on someone who stops treatment and then comes back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good point. We won't have to worry about it this 6 months, though.
Okay, thank you very much.
Linda Brueggemann.
Hi, thank you. I've got a couple of questions. The first one just related to the data that was used. I just want to clarify, because in the video presentation you showed PSR, but I'm assuming that those 9,000 hours that were used of PSR were community support group, community supports, or PSR group, PSR individual, and community support group all rolled together, since that's how we're being asked to reauthorize with those all rolled together. So the data was a combination of all those different services, correct?
No, that's a good question. The data was PSR services, individual and group. The reason for including community support group in the services with PSR is that we knew that there were some providers who were starting to request to no longer provide any PSR, and they were moving to community support group services. And while as a division we certainly support the increased use of community support, and we believe that that is one step closer to natural settings and recovery-based services, we want to make sure that, as I said earlier, that it's not one service just being called by a different name, so that it's not PSR just being called community support group, and that it really is community support group. Also, we believe that when we designed PSR, we designed it really to go hand-in-hand with community support, and we believe that community support group is a natural progression from PSR. And so we want to make sure that as we're managing our risk that we're looking at that full spectrum of service. But when we looked at the data that concerned us was really the PSR utilization data. But because we're seeing this trend in a move away from PSR in some agencies to CSG, we included that in this program.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. Kind of related to that then, with PSR, looking at the continuing service criteria, one of those continuing service criteria for PSR is that the individual cannot effectively utilize other treatment modalities, including community support services or therapy counseling, without the concurrent provision of PSR. Since you are including community support group in the service limits for PSR, it seems a little bit unfair to deny PSR services to an individual who could utilize community support in lieu of PSR, because if you deny the PSR, you're also simultaneously denying the community support that would be that more natural progression. It's more of a comment than a question, but just the very criteria you're establishing, and the same thing applies if you look at the community support group criteria, that they're going to be denied if they require the intensity of contact and range of supportive interventions that are only available through more intensive services, which would be things like PSR. So on both hands, the denial related to the continuing service criteria are work against each other, that we can't say that you're going to deny a service because they'd be better served if they got community support, but in denying the PSR, you also deny them the opportunity to do that less intensive, or vice versa, deny community support group because they need more intensive services, but in denying the community support group, you're also denying the more intensive service of PSR since you're counting the hours together. Again, it just comes back to, I know something that was raised on all of the webinars that we've been in on related to this, that the CSG and PSR really should be separated out because they are two different types of services.
Okay, I want to address a couple of things with that. The PSR and the CSG, as you said, are separate services, and for purpose of authorization, each of those services has their own criteria. I'm not sure what you mean by we're denying one, because the idea is that we are requiring authorization at a certain point in time. If the service is medically necessary, then the authorization will be provided. The service initiation criteria and the continuing service criteria, when it's talking about a person, one of the reasons a person might need to continue PSR, that they are getting benefit from other types of treatment such as therapy counseling or community support, because they're also getting that intensive skill building of PSR, that doesn't mean that they can't get one service because they're getting the other one. And I want to make sure that that's clear. So I don't know if I've addressed your question or not. It's hard for me not having the criteria in front of me to address it any more than that. I don't know, Rusty, if you want to say anything more about it or not. But
did that help any?
Well, a little bit. I guess that when I said deny, what I meant was, let's say we had put in for reauthorization on PSR services, and those are, and that is denied. I guess maybe this is just, I need clarification, because if we reauthorize both PSR and we put in a reauthorization for community support group, and you deny the reauthorization for PSR but approve the reauthorization for community support group, then we'd be able to bill community support group, but we would not be able to bill PSR. Is that correct?
Even correct. Though if you don't have a current authorization and you've exceeded that 800 units, you would not be able to submit bills for PSR.
Okay, and so then I guess the flip side of it, and this is where, again, not having them separated out becomes a little bit frustrating for us providers, is if we have, let's say we reauthorize both, if we reauthorize both PSR and CSG, and they both are approved, and we get 200 hours reauthorized for each one, so 800 units, but 200 hours. If they use 150 hours of PSR and they use 250 hours of community support group, is that going to be approved, even though your authorization for PSR was only 200 and for CSG it was only 200?
No, because they're separate services, and so that's the reason why you are requesting
your best estimate of how much service you are going to provide to them is because that has to be entered in the system, and because they're separate services with separate codes, there are units of authorization that are entered. Correct, Emily?
Yeah, they're submitted separately, so the auth would be for each of the services individually.
Okay, so if you're going to hold me to what I submit individually, it does not seem fair that providers are then being held to the services being counted against them as a group, because what had been said in an earlier caller, I believe with Demetrius, was if he had some community support group going on, that those hours are going to be pulling down the PSR hours as well, because the hours are counted collectively. And yet you're saying I have to authorize them separately. So if I only ask for 200 hours of PSR and I ask for 200 hours of CSG and both get approved, but my client starts really doing better in PSR and we're starting to move them more into the community support group, I can't go beyond that 200 hours of community support without reauthorizing, even if I use less of the PSR. But you're counting them all together. It's a little bit confusing as to how we providers are being asked to put the hours collectively together, but we have to do two separate authorizations, and we're going to be held to what we put in those authorizations. Although in the therapy side, you don't seem to do that. Because what you answered on a previous caller was, if I ask for 40 units of therapy and I think I need 20 of group and 20 of individual, but I use 30 of group and 10 of individual, that's okay. So I think if you're going to allow that on the therapy side, then that same allowance should be given to the community support group and PSR. Something to think about. I'd ask that the state consider that.
Yeah, and we've noted your comments. It's again, a different situation because they are different services. So part of it is a systems issue why you have to enter hours. But because therapy counseling is one service, regardless of whether you're doing individual, group, or family, it's reported differently in the system.
True.
Where the other two services are separate. But we hear your concern.
Yeah, and this is Jackie, and I think you did a very good job of pointing out that contradiction there, and I'll be sure we follow up on that.
All right, thank you. One other question, just wanting to seek some confirmation. There was a comment made that services provided during this time, that 14-day reconsideration period, if you are appealing, would be eligible for reimbursement. So my question is, if we appeal and we're providing services, I understand that those services would be eligible for reimbursement, but let's say the appeal is denied. At the end of that 14-day window, we get a denial. Are we still going to be paid for the services provided during those 14 days prior to the denial being received? Or is it going to go back and say it's only going to be paid, they're eligible only if you actually eventually get approval?
The policy that DMH has published related to appeals and reconsideration requests is that we will reimburse services provided during those periods of time. So regardless of the outcome of the reconsideration request or the appeal.
And does that same eligibility then apply if it's the next level of appeal taken to the director and or the HFS administrative law level?
Yes.
Okay. All right, I think another question.
Yeah, about mental health parity.
A question about mental health parity.
Therapy counseling.
With regard to the therapy counseling, I know their limits is not the right word, but the fact that we have to seek reauthorization and potentially there would be limits put if the authorization is denied, that is a limit. As I understand it, there was regulations that went into effect January 1st regarding mental health parity and the ability
to have therapy done. It has to be it can equal medical
therapy. That therapy has to mental health services therapy has to be provided at the same extent that medical services are provided. That you can't discriminate against mental health services. This was new legal rules that went into effect as of January 1. And so just wondering if the state has addressed and how they're dealing with mental health parity so as to avoid anything like class action lawsuits or any more things in the state of Illinois down the line.
This is Rusty, the consultant. The mental health parity law does not apply to Medicare or Medicaid at all at this stage. Medicare and Medicaid is set by a separate policy, and according to the state plan, which is negotiated with federal CMS, mental health parity applied to certain levels and sizes of private sector insurance plans.
Okay. All right. Thank you for clarifying that. And then actually I had one other.
This is Jackie. I'd like to comment, even if it doesn't apply to Medicaid. The key here is the medical necessity piece. So as long as a service, whether it be therapy or it be a medical service, in order for it Medicaid to pay, it needs to be medically necessary. So I don't think the parity is anything solely about mental health services. It's all about, does the client medically need a service? And if the answer is yes, then it's there for the client.
Okay. I think the concern probably for most of us agencies is the medical necessity determination being made based on paperwork and not being made based on actually meeting the clients. Because we can be here and clearly know that it is absolutely medically necessary. But if we send in multiple sheets of paper with the mental health assessment and the IPP and progress notes, it's still going to be a subjective decision made by the collaborative clinical case managers as to whether or not they feel it is appropriate.
And I would just point out again, this is Rusty, that federal policy for determination of medical necessity is also based on paper. Federal auditors who come in who determine medical necessity and other compliance with federal rules base that solely on what is documented in the medical record, and in many cases may not set foot or even know the state at all and still make that determination. So the fact that the state is using in-state LPHAs who are knowledgeable about the system is actually far more advanced than what federal auditing would be in a similar situation.
All right. Well, that is good to know. The last question is, if a client, this is related to the therapy, if a client has used their 40 units, say, and maybe 3 to 6 months later they have a mental health crisis, we know that we have to wait at least 7 days or potentially up to 7 days for a reauthorization. So would that agency be able to continue to bill crisis intervention services for potentially 7 to 10 days, depending on how the weekend falls, while we're waiting for authorization for more therapy, if we are having to provide them with basically intensive therapy services, but I can't bill therapy because I don't have an authorization yet?
Well, again, if you're going to bill a Rule 132 service, you need to bill it according to the definition.
Okay.
And so if a person is having a crisis, then crisis intervention is appropriate, and crisis is defined by the rule. So, you have to look at the rule and let that be your guide. In addition, if a person has been out of service for 3 to 6 months, I would assume that some assessment is going to happen with that person and some discussion of their treatment plan and their treatment needs is going to happen. And so those are separate services. Mental health assessment.
Oh, certainly.
Planning are separate services from therapy counseling. And certainly those services are not services that are the focus of the utilization management program. So those are also services that might be appropriate and that might be the actual service you're providing in that initial period of time.
Okay. And then just one last comment related to the therapy hours. And I understand where you presented the data in terms of where you came up with these 75 percentile limits. But since, you know, we're an agency that works with both DD and MH, and under the Department of DD, it's interesting that therapy is, we're given 60 hours of therapy a year for those clients, and yet, you know, we're looking at a 10-hour before we can reauthorize. So just something, it's just odd, the difference between the mental health and the DD side. So something to think about.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Becca, this is Sean Wilson. In order to allow for closing comments for today's call and also finish the call in a timely manner, we'd like to allow for one more final question for this afternoon. Thanks.
Thank you. And the next question will come from Renee Caliendo.
Thank you. My question's been answered.
Becca, we can go ahead and field one more.
Next question will come from Carol Craig.
Oh. I actually had two, but I'll make them quick. One was if a clinician did not accurately estimate the total number of additional services needed and the client needed more, can you submit a second request for more units of service in the same fiscal year?
Yes.
Okay. And the only other thing I wanted to ask about, I think you already covered the community support group things, but for individuals like Scylla clients, for example, that might have been worked with for years to get up to a certain optimal level of skills, but they still, without the service, say without laundry group, without banking group, without grocery shopping group, they would lose the skill or not complete the task as needed. Would that justify medical necessity in continuing those kinds of services? You know, it's more of a thing where they might not show a lot of progress, but if you remove the service, they will show a decline in their mental health and their ability to take care of themselves.
Yeah, and again, it's really hard to give blanket statements that say, yes, anybody that does this would automatically be authorized. But certainly any concerns that you have about a person's decline if they don't receive a service is something that you should include in documentation that you send to support the authorization.
And so you could go back historically and say, you know, at this time when we withdrew this service, this happened. This is why we want to continue providing it, that type of thing?
Certainly. You could include that in, you know, some kind of summary document that you want to send, or it might even be in the mental health assessment documents. But anything like that, I would think that you'd want to make sure that you included for the clinical care managers. Again, the clinical care managers are being instructed by the Division of Mental Health to make good, sound clinical decisions based, and they can only do that with good, sound clinical documentation.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, this is Jackie. I'd like to just say I have found this to be very helpful to hear the comments from the field, and I wanted to thank Leanne and the collaborative staff for being willing to do this on such short notice. I know the director has asked us to consider ways of communicating with the providers on a more regular basis until we are sure that, you know, the questions and concerns have been addressed. So we may choose to do this again, or we may look at another forum to answer questions and concerns. But I just wanted to say from my perspective, this was very helpful, and there are a couple of things that we will follow up directly with the individuals. Leanne, anything you want to say before we give it to Lori?
Well, I would just like to thank those of you who've been on both of the previous calls for tolerating my voice for 8.5 hours now. Certainly we always appreciate the opportunity to talk directly with providers, and your input is very valuable to us. And we will continue our efforts to work collaboratively with you. And as you have suggestions for improvements, please you know, give those to your regional contract managers who will get them to us, or, you know, you can always send them directly to me, but usually your most rapid channel of communication is through your regions.
Director Jones, are you still with us?
I am, and I think you all have wrapped it up very nicely, so I don't need to repeat all that's been said given the late hour, but thank you so much for participating, and we'll continue to work to improve the system until it's exactly what we all will hope for.
Okay, Sean.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Jones and Jackie. And again, just a reminder for the listening audience before we conclude the call today, both the audio recording and the PowerPoint presentation from this afternoon will be provided by early to mid-next week on, again, the collaborative website provider information page. The PowerPoint will be under the clinical and utilization management heading, and the audio recording, again in MP3 format, will be under the provider resources heading on that same page. So with that said, again, thank you, everyone, and we will conclude our call for this afternoon. Becca, if you would, please disconnect the main line and push the speakers through to post-conference.